Hello and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. I'm Galen Druk. This week, the Trump administration shared the statistical modeling it's using to make policy decisions about COVID-19, and it was a grim picture. Their models projected that 100 to 240,000 Americans could die from COVID-19, even with mitigation measures in place, and that without those measures, the numbers could reach into the millions. We at 538 spend a lot of time modeling outcomes for elections and sports, but as you might have guessed, modeling the course of a novel pandemic is very different. There are so many variables and such little historical data to work with. So today, we're going to lay out what makes creating a COVID-19 model so difficult and just how much is unknown. And here with me to do that are 538's senior science writer, Maggie Kurth. Hi, Maggie.
Hi.
Also here with us is 538's quantitative editor, Laura Bronner. Hi, Laura.
Hi, Galen and Maggie.
And in case you haven't seen it, Maggie and Laura, along with our colleague Jasmine Mitani, recently published a piece on the website called Why It's So Freaking Hard to Make a Good COVID-19 Model. And I encourage everyone to go check it out. There are great graphics there. A really phenomenal piece that helped me understand what all is unknown in what we're going through. Just to begin, Maggie, at this point, what is the range of outcomes that's being modeled for COVID-19 in the United States?
Well, it's pretty big. I mean, it depends a lot on what the different scenarios are that you're talking about. So we have seen everything from scenarios where you are expecting some of these social distancing setups to be happening in all 50 states, and then you're kind of down to, like, you know, 100,000, 200,000 people, all the way up to, without anything in place, 2 million. And that's deaths. And that is a pretty big range. I mean, one of the things we pointed out in our story is that if you go back and look at deaths from disasters across the world, that's the difference between, you know, the kinds of death rates we live with every year from accidents and violence in the United States and something that changes a country forever and that is a major turning point in its history. So we have these really big ranges. We don't know what's correct. It's probably not actually a correct answer. And that's kind of leaving us all to deal with a lot of uncertainty.
Laura, what are the main pieces of data that you need to know in order to try to model this thing in the first place?
It depends how deep you want to go, essentially. One way to try and get at this is to sort of look at the three pieces of information that we sort of set out in the piece, which is, one, what is the susceptible population, which is the population that could possibly get this disease. Then, two, what is the infection rate? So, like, how quickly is this spreading from person to person? And then third, what is the fatality rate? So how many of those who will get the infection are going to die? And so those three are the sort of the three things that you need to know. The issue is that, like, none of those three things are very easy to know. None of them are things that you can just read off of some kind of data source. All of them have to be modeled, and that's where the difficulty sets in.
Yeah, it's not just that it's unknown blank. It's that it's an unknown blank that's based on other unknown blanks, and it's just like stacks and stacks and stacks of assumptions.
When it comes to susceptible population, the infection rate, and then the fatality rate, how close have we gotten to figuring out what they are? Do we have any sense of what those rates are? I mean, we're not completely in the dark, right?
So one of the things that is tough for me right now is that we are changing this stuff all the time. So, like, last week, I probably would have told you that we have a pretty good idea of, if not the fatality rate of, like, the mortality, you know, known cases that die. But now I'm not entirely certain that that's true, because we're starting to get this credible reporting out of China that's suggesting that the actual mortality was much higher than they were reporting to the world. So there's always just, like, this new information coming in, and I think that that ends up making it really hard to say stuff definitively. I mean, like, this is something I've run into with every story I've been writing about this, is it feels like the next week it's out of date.
Laura, how are you processing what these rates might be, how close we can get at this point in time with the limited data that we have?
There do seem to be different numbers coming out of different places. I mean, as Maggie said, the issue is that a lot of this is based on reporting in these different places, and we often don't know what goes into the reporting. I mean, even just counting the cases is not straightforward. Do you sort of count only confirmed tests? And then you get into like all the issues with, you know, are the tests actually accurate? What are the false positive and false negative rates? I mean, that's a whole other thing. But, you know, even if you are assuming that that's not an issue, which I don't really think we can, the question is like, are you just confirming the positive tests, as I said, which in, for example, in this country, there just aren't that many people being tested compared to like the people that want tests, the people that have symptoms? Or do you include people who present as classic cases, even if they haven't been confirmed as a test? All of these things really, all of these decisions really matter for what your infection rates, what your fatality rates end up being. I do think there are, for example, the basic reproduction number, the R-naught, there are estimates from different scientific papers that range quite far. I think most of them have been in the range of something like 2 to 3, meaning that a person who is infected will infect 2 to 3 additional people in the susceptible population. Of course, that will change as fewer people become susceptible if there is actually immunity conferred by having had the disease. That's another thing we don't really know. So yeah, I mean, every part of the... I don't want to say that epidemiologists are... know absolutely nothing, because I do think that there are things that they have been learning and studying, and there are a crazy number of papers that have been coming out, a lot of them not yet peer-reviewed, but there is a lot of data coming out. The issue is that it's very hard to read that as a layperson, I think.
One of the things that this reminded me of is the fact that death data reporting is not nearly as straightforward, just broadly, as I think a lot of people assume that it is. And we ran into this at 538 when we were doing that big package on gun violence statistics, Galen, if you remember, you were around for that, I think.
Yeah.
Where we were going and looking at how gun deaths got reported as accidents or not. And like that ended up depending on who happened to be the county coroner and how they completely subjectively interpreted a situation. And it's a lot of that same kind of thing happening here. Like the United States, because of the way that, you know, federalism works, we don't have this single top-down structure where everybody has the same form and fills out the exact same data and sends it into the same place. You know, the CDC can encourage that to happen. They have like incentives and they have like ways that they can kind of try to get that more cohesive. But ultimately, it's this weird conglomeration of data collection at the level of cities, counties, states, all the way up to the federal. And there's so many ways that it can get just like not able to be well compared between point A and, you know, point Z.
To take one example here, you have an idea that death rates might be higher among older people and among people who have underlying conditions. But a lot of those people, as you know, that implies, are already sick, right? They already have like maybe heart issues or lung issues or something. And then the disease is on top of that. And so it's kind of unclear, like, did they die of the disease or did the disease like speed up a death that maybe would have already happened? We don't know the counterfactual. And we'd also, I mean, so we don't know it sort of for that person, but we also don't know how that's being counted. So there's like two levels of like, should it be counted? And then the other thing is like, we don't know what decision is being made in each of these individual cases. And so that is making it really hard.
I was reading a message board the other day where doctors were debating whether you should be counting people who don't even have COVID symptoms, but like if they die in the hospital because the hospital doesn't have capacity because of COVID, should that count as a COVID death?
Right. But then that still sort of assumes that you're testing everyone who died for whether they had it, which is also, I think, not happening.
Yeah. I mean, we do have a couple cases that have served as some sort of study for what happens when you test large portions of the population. I think that was on the Diamond Princess cruise, where they tested the large majority of the people on board before they let them disembark. And then also Iceland, which has been, more than any other country, testing people who may be asymptomatic. You know, these are not peer-reviewed studies at this point, necessarily. But have we learned anything from those experiments, so to say, that has gotten us closer to an answer on these questions?
So we've learned that there are a lot of people walking around infected who would never be identified as infected by any other way. We know that some people are going to get really, really sick and be obvious, and other people may have no symptoms at all. And what proportion of people infected have no symptoms, I think, is kind of up in the air, mainly because, like, the Diamond Princess is not a representative population. I got an email from some people in the Icelandic public health organizations this morning, so I'm hopefully going to have a little bit more understanding of this soon. But, like, my understanding right now is that the Icelandic setup is a volunteer basis, so you're taking a random sample from people who self-selected to be getting this test. So I'm not sure, like, how representative that actually is either. And we don't really know, like, what proportion, but we know that some are.
Yeah. I mean, and the Diamond Princess as well. I mean, I think that that's, as you say, a really interesting example because they tested so many people and because they, you know, the people were sort of confined, right? I mean, one of the issues with this virus is that, like, people are traveling, people are coming in contact with other people. And so the advantage of a cruise ship is people are not doing that by and large. And there they found that about, I think, half of the people who tested positive were asymptomatic, which is huge. I mean, that's a huge proportion. The other thing, though, is that the population on a cruise ship is not super representative of the general population in any country. I mean, they're going to be older, they're going to be wealthier, they're going to be the type of people that go on a cruise ship. It's informative and it has advantages, especially in that it's, you know, as I said, a sort of set population with few people going in and out. But it also has disadvantages, namely the lack of representativeness.
Well, I think you and I, Laura, had talked a little bit about how interesting it was that, like, even in that population on the Diamond Princess, there wasn't exact fatality rates, right? The fatality rate was still a range, and a really big one. Like, I think it was something like 0.6% to 5.8% for this population that was, you know, essentially trapped and mostly tested. So it just kind of shows you, like, how even under, like, the really what should be easy conditions, I guess, for research, it's still not exact.
Right. Science is hard.
Amen. So
science is hard.
You started to get into this a little bit, but we do have a lot of countries beyond just those, well, Iceland and the Diamond Princess example, giving us data. You mentioned, Maggie, that different states have different ways of collecting all of this data. So even within the United States, we may have differences from state to state. What about relying on Italy's data? And I think you addressed a little bit about relying on China's data. What can we get from that and what can't we?
I mean, this is a very existential question, Galen. We can get something out of it. I think that one of the things that this is sort of forcing us to do, like this being, you know, the entire coronavirus thing, is living with uncertainty and making decisions with uncertainty and kind of having to have all of these situations where we're like, we don't actually know the answer. We don't actually have the data. We've got to do the best we can with what we've got. And that's scary and that's hard. And it is not something humans are very good at mentally processing. We want answers and there's not actually going to be answers.
Yeah. I mean, I think the Italy and China cases particularly, so one is, as I said, like the counting question, right? Specifically in China, if you look at some of the earlier charts, I'm going to try and explain this, but there's sort of a bump in cases that looks really strange. And that's essentially because, like, they changed the way that they were counting cases, right? And so that's, like, an obvious change that, like, is so obvious that it's labeled on a lot of charts. But there are all these changes that are happening all the time that aren't labeled and they that just aren't large enough to look weird, but they still affect the way the data is being collected and they still affect how we should be interpreting it. Another thing is like the population in these places, right? I mean, one thing we think we know is that, like, as I said earlier, it affects older people more, that they have more severe outcomes. China has way fewer people over 65 than the US does. Italy has more. And so the way that those things play out in these different countries is also a function of the population structure in these countries. The US, as I said, is sort of in between, but then also the US has like higher rates of diabetes, for example, but lower rates of smoking. And so since we don't know exactly how all these factors play into the disease progression and the severity of symptoms and all that stuff, we can't make exact statements, but we do have reason to believe that it will affect all these things.
We've talked about the fatality rate, and you mentioned the demographics of the population matter, what other underlying diseases they may have, hospital capacity. The other factor here that we've talked about is infection rate. So how many people each individual who has the novel coronavirus goes on to infect? What are the unknowns there?
One of the things that stood out to me that I thought was really interesting was the fact that it's probably, you know, when we're talking about that transmission rate, we're talking about an average, and it's not going to be the same from person to person. And we don't necessarily know what factors affect that yet. Like, I mean, like Laura and I have heard speculation that we can't find data to back up for different things. And we have also seen cases where, like, you know, that one woman in South Korea that just spread it all over, or the Biogen conference in Boston that was at one point responsible for almost the entire state's COVID cases. You know, so you have like these events that can be affected by something as non-biological as whatever is happening with the HVAC system in a building, all the way up to whether you're a smoker, all the way up to like the biology of the virus interacting with your biology. And that's another whole set of unknowns we just don't have.
Right. And one of the biggest things here, obviously, is the interventions that are being taken. Like social distancing obviously has a huge impact on the rate of contact between people. And that, since that's how the virus spreads, that's going to have a huge impact on the transmission rate overall. But yeah, I mean, there, you know, as Maggie mentioned, just the geography of how it spreads, you know, since this is traveling over humans, just the places that people travel and the types of people they're in contact with and how closely they're in contact with them and all that stuff has a huge effect on where the next hotspots are. And then that in turn, is it an urban area? Is it a rural area? How much contact do people have on average? All that stuff sort of travels down the line. And then are symptomatic people more infectious than asymptomatic people? That's something we don't really know yet. But obviously that interacts with how many people or like what proportion of people that get it are asymptomatic to affect ultimately the transmission rate.
And like that ends up affecting what we do for interventions too. So like one of the early stories that I had written during this was about a bunch of epidemiologists sort of telling me that quarantine was not really that effective of a means of stopping a virus, because you get like these big groups of uninfected people that you don't have any reason to believe are actually carrying the virus. You try to block them off, but then because of human psychology, they start kind of like poking the holes and getting out, and that actually doesn't really prevent the spread very much. But now we're in this space where we're kind of having to do some of this, because the stuff that those researchers were recommending, you know, the idea of like identifying cases and isolating the people that we do know have it and that we do know have actually been exposed, aren't really working, partly because of the logistics problems around our testing infrastructure, and partly because this virus is so, we think, so infectious before you even have any symptoms to know that you have it. And that makes it hard. Like, that's one of the things that makes it harder than SARS, you know, from back in the early 2000s, is that SARS wasn't really infectious until you were expressing symptoms. And then it was pretty easy to just like lock those people down.
Yeah. So here comes, I think, the biggest question of all. regardless of all of these unknowns and all of these challenges in trying to model the trajectory of this pandemic, epidemiologists have come up with models. We've seen them all. President Trump displayed them for the country on Tuesday. We've talked about them on the podcast. Lots of academic institutions have tried this. So, Laura, what have they done to try to overcome some of these challenges and model this virus, understanding that it's hard?
There are different things that you can do. One is sort of look at the wealth of data and try and make informed assumptions about certain parameters. So I think the Imperial College study made certain assumptions about how long people are infectious for and like the duration before you get symptoms that you're infectious for and how many people were going to comply with social distancing rules and stuff like that. But then the other thing that I think that report in particular did a really good job of is sort of trying to test a range of inputs and see what effect that had on the estimates overall. So I think particularly for the UK data, what they did was they looked at sort of like a range of R-naughts, of like basic reproduction numbers. And then they looked at like a range of different triggers of when interventions would be taken. And they sort of multiplied that out in a matrix to sort of see, well, if you have a relatively low R-naught, if you have like a basic reproduction number of 2 and a relatively low threshold for triggering an intervention, what does that effect have? And then you sort of, you can multiply all of those things out and then you get a sort of like matrix of outcomes. So that's called sensitivity analysis. And it's a great way to try and play out some of these, how some of these ranges really affect what you're interested in. But you can't really do that. I mean, we've touched on, I don't know, 30, 40 unknowns here. You can't really play that out for all of these factors, right? And so, like I said, they do have to make assumptions about certain things. And obviously, they're experts, and so those assumptions are informed. But I mean, that's kind of part of what underlies all these different projections by different groups, is that different people are making different assumptions, right? I think one of the University of Washington models that I think are part of what the administration is basing their response on is, I think they're assuming that the social distancing measures in the US are sort of comparable to the ones in China. And I'm not sure if that's a plausible assumption, for example. So I think that there are certain things there that, like, what assumptions are being made it is quite key to understanding how you arrive at the outcomes that you arrive at.
And I think, like, one thing that occurred to me as, like, a way of sort of framing this is that none of these models that we're looking at are going to get it exactly right. And that is not going to mean that the people that did them are stupid. Like, that's not going to mean that they are wrong or bad. It is going to mean that, like, no one's going to get this right because it's predicting the future. And to the extent of, like, the level of detail you want, that's impossible.
Right. I mean, part of that is the Imperial College report predicted, you know, if no interventions were taken, 2.2 million deaths in the US, and I think about 500,000 deaths in the UK. But then obviously both countries did take measures. And so as a response to that initial forecast, measures were taken that will hopefully prove that forecast wrong, right? So, like, in a way, a forecast that was maybe correct initially, as a result of it coming out, will make itself incorrect. And that's good, right? That's what we want. It's not, that doesn't mean that the forecast was bad, even if it turns out to have been wrong.
Yeah, it's sort of like early on in this, I saw a lot of epidemiologists sort of talking about, if we do this right, you know, a couple months from now, you'll be saying that we all overreacted.
Right.
And that won't mean that we overreacted. That means that we did it right. And I think it's kind of the same thing with these models. You know, like, ideally, a few months from now, there will be a lot of people being like, wow, those models really overestimated deaths. And if we do this right, yeah, that will be the case. But it's because of these models coming out and changing behavior, and then the behavior changes the outcomes. You know, nothing's happening in a vacuum here. It's the fog of war. It's going on as we're trying to study it.
So it seems like there's a pretty large margin of uncertainty here, which listeners to this podcast are very familiar with from a political standpoint. Laura, how exactly is modeling this different from, say, modeling an election where we already acknowledge that there is plenty of uncertainty, but it seems here there's just vastly more uncertainty?
Yeah, I mean, I think, modeling elections is also hard. I think in general, sort of 538 type models look at previous presidential elections, for example, and try to see the factors that were important for how those played out, right? So, like, I think in general, we use elections since, I think, 1972, which is like the modern presidential election era. And the way that you identify which factors are important is that you sort of like test them in that sample, right? And that, I don't want to say that that's like the easiest thing. 12 elections or however many is still not that many elections to be testing stuff on. But there are certain things that are quite predictable. Like partisanship is pretty predictable. Like there are only a certain number of states that are probably going to be swinging possibly one way or the other, right? Many states are just, how they're going to vote. And stuff like that makes that kind of thing more predictable. This is just a whole different beast, right? I mean, we talked about all the unknowns, but also there's just nothing, or there are very few comparable cases to be basing your modeling on. And those are all different in pretty substantial ways. I mean, the 1918 Spanish flu pandemic, that was over 100 years ago, right? Like quite a lot has changed since then. So it's sort of hard to be like, oh, well, in that case, it that's what happened. And so we can say with some amount of certainty that this is going to happen this time. And then, other things that have happened since, like SARS or MERS or the other, like, flu pandemics in, like, 57 and stuff, like, those were all quite different, right? I mean, they all had, like, very different factors that made them a very different beast to model. And in the absence of comparable data, it's just very hard to have that kind of certainty. Even the certainty that, like, we have with modeling presidential elections, which is still pretty large.
One of the things that like a emergency doctor at Mount Sinai told me early on in this that kind of stuck with me was that, we have not been in the U.S. affected by a pandemic since like 1968. And our healthcare system has changed vastly since then in the way that we approach healthcare, in the way that our incentives have been set up for like how we dispense care and like what kinds of things we focus on. We've had 40, 50 years of this emphasis on good emphasis on technology to save the lives of individuals who are previously not savable, right? But we've not had the same kind of emphasis and the same kinds of incentives for like how do you get a mass of people through something that affects everybody at once. That's just not what the incentives have been on. And so we can, we can save somebody from heart failure and transplant a heart into them and like keep it pumping. You know, we have these ECMO machines that can take your blood out and process it in a little machine and like send it back in. But we don't have the infrastructure for hundreds of people showing up needing a hospital bed for 2 weeks.
Yeah. So just a fundamental lack of historical data. And that's kind of the challenge that's going to come up with any novel virus is like the thing that makes it novel is that we don't have any data about it before. And therefore, it makes it so much harder to model. I mean, wrapping up here, what kind of lessons do you take away from this experience about the scientific method and how I think that in general, we tend to think that like science can answer the questions that we have. Like if you just know how to crunch the numbers, if you like just collect the data, I don't know, does this just say, no, that's not true?
I mean, I think that what I'm taking away from this is the importance of sort of subject matter expertise, right? I think that there are a lot of people who are like, oh, I have some experience with some data analysis. I know how to do this. I've done models of something. And so I can do a model of this, or I can at least try and I can put it on Medium and then I can see what happens, right? And I think that this is like, it's really hard to do well, that's why people have devoted their lives to this. And it's also kind of dangerous because people are really looking for information and they're looking for data to tell you something and to give you more certainty. As Maggie said, I think that this is like something that's really hard fundamentally on a human level to deal with, this lack of certainty and the lack of anything hard to, you know, hang your hat on. And I think that requiring subject matter expertise is, I think, really important in order to just have, you know, to understand what are the range of plausible outcomes. So we talked to one epidemiologist. This is when we were researching the piece, and I was at this point getting quite disillusioned with models as a whole and getting quite desperate about, well, how can we ever know anything, right? If there are, you know, an endless number of variables and each of those variables has a range that, you know, ranges from, you know, something quite low to something quite high. If you were trying to multiply out that uncertainty and like propagate the uncertainty through every parameter in the model, you would end up with something like, you know, zero people would die to everyone in the US would die, right? And that would be your range. And that would obviously be like an entirely useless output of your model, right? And so I asked him, like, how do you deal with that? And I mean, what he told me is that, like, ultimately, the uncertainties in your model are correlated to some extent. The issue is that it's very hard to identify those correlation structures, like how those variables are correlated with each other. And so, you know, like it might be impossible to have like a low value of this parameter, but a high value of this parameter, because that just doesn't happen. But that's something that you need expertise to know, right? Like I, as you know, the quantitative editor here, don't know that because it's not my expertise. And so I think that to me has been like a really good example of like trying to narrow down this like impossibly huge range is something that you need expertise for. And like, obviously different people can still make different decisions or have different ideas of what assumptions are plausible. And that's why you have different models. And that's also important. But I think you need that expertise to make those decisions in the first place.
So probably here is the good place to say that we at 538 are not going to be putting out a COVID-19 model, and it's exactly for the reasons that you just laid out. So thank you, Laura.
please stop emailing us asking for one.
Maggie, what's your final lesson here?
I think that like it sort of comes back to the difference between like what we teach people science is in grade school, junior high, high school, and like what it actually is. And I think in the kinds of science classes that most people have had, it's sort of taught as a collection of facts, as a collection of absolutes, as this, like, now we know a thing. Somebody did an experiment, and now we have a fact. And, like, here, we give you this fact, and you memorize it, and you have that in your brain, and now you know. And actual science is messier than that. Actual science is failure. It is not knowing. It is having a range of possible options that we don't actually know which one is right. And it, especially like when you're in the process of doing it, like you're not going to get actual answers. You're going to get probabilities and possibilities. And that uncertainty then, I think, kind of becomes a psychology thing where we, I think, have to find ways as individuals, as reporters helping people, you know, whatever we're doing, we have to find ways to kind of figure out how to deal with that uncertainty in our lives, because it's not going away. It's just become bigger.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's leave it there. That's an important note to end on. So thank you, Maggie.
Thanks, Galen.
And thank you, Laura.
Thanks for having us.
My name is Galen Druk. Tony Chow is in the virtual control room. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or review at the Apple Podcast Store or tell someone about us. You can also find 538 on YouTube. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.